Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Margot Wallström, who is Vice President of the European Commission. She is on the Berkeley campus to inaugurate the European Union Center for Excellence on the Berkeley campus. Ms. Wallström, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in the very north of Sweden. I come from a working class family, and I was raised with what somebody said was hard work, the virtues of hard work, common sense, and bad taste. And had a very lucky upbringing, happy upbringing, I would say.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world beyond what you just said?
I think through being very clear about their values and as I said, you know, hard work was the first message we got. You have to work hard. You have to behave. You have to be honest and stay sober, and then things will go well. I also think we were lucky because we belonged to a generation that had immense hope for the future. Everything was possible, and this was the impression. And they always talked to me about education.
Was there discussion of politics around the dinner table?
No, not very much. No, from that point of view, I may be unusual because there was not a tradition of trade union activism or political discussions. Not very much. But I think it was a very political time. So we knew also who were the underdogs and who were the ones who decided in society. So I think we had a clear understanding of the world.
Still. And so what led you into politics in Sweden?
I don't know if it was a coincidence, but my neighbor actually asked me if I wanted to start a branch of the Social Democratic Youth. And I didn't know very much what that was all about. But I also felt that we missed something to do and a place to be for the young people in my village. So when she described it as also a social activity, I said, well, yeah, why not?
And ultimately you were you served in the legislature the parliament in Sweden.
Yes.
Talk a little about that, the campaigning, the getting the sense of what people want, because that experience clearly affects your present agenda.
Definitely. And of course, I was a youth candidate. I was, I think when I came to the Swedish parliament, I was the youngest ever. And of course, it meant that what was expected from me was also to campaign on issues that had to do with youth unemployment and the things that young people cared a lot about. But I can compared with today, of course, environment issues were not really on the agenda yet, but it had to do with pay, salaries for young people, and to get a job and somewhere to live. Mm-hmm. I think that of course, has very much shaped also my understanding of politics, what is important, and it was a very exciting experience to be young in the parliament.
A theme that comes up in a lot of my interviews on issues such as youth, on women's rights, on the environment, is the extent to which or how the political leaders get the message. And I'm curious what you might help us understand about that. In other words, is it that in campaigning you see the problems and then work with people to articulate the position? How does the message come from the bottom up?
That's a very good question because I, of course, feel that in those days it was much more of activism on the grassroots level. I mean, we were organized in branches. We had so many clubs, social democratic youth clubs, and we had a very strong party, active also at the local municipality level, so to say, and the whole way through. And you were expected to sort of do your service in that organization. So you had to go to meetings, you had to make coffee for the meetings. You had to prepare everything, and this was also a listening exercise. And then we would go to schools, we would go to arrange public meetings, we would have to engage with trade unions and really a kind of broad listening exercise. Today you use other channels, and I see that this is not so common any longer, that you have the same type of activism at the local level.
You also served in the Swedish government.
Yes.
And there your portfolio was both youth and women, right?
Yes, yeah. And then health, because I served in two governments, so first for 3 years and then for 4 years. Mm-hmm. So in total, 7 years. But it started with a portfolio that was very mixed, with including youth issues and church issues. We had a church, a state church, for a long time in Sweden. So, but that's correct. Also women issues.
Anita Grodin was a guest on our program, and I'm curious, did women, were you a beneficiary of the women's movement, or were you in it early enough to help sort of lead it? And then how, I'm curious about your consciousness, other than being a woman, about, you know, the real obstacles that women have in all roles.
I think my entry was more through the youth organization. Mm-hmm. I was not in those days engaged in the women's branches of the party, for example. But this became clearly, I mean, this was part of my portfolio, and it was a very exciting time, because I think this was in the debate in society, where women claimed their proper sort of role and part in society. So I helped to shape a lot of the legislation, even though I can also see that most of these issues are still there. They are not solved, but we have, I think, advanced a lot. And I would say that the Nordic countries, and Sweden in particular, have come a long way compared with the other countries in Europe, for example. I would say we are very, very advanced.
Looking at your experiences, what is most important in training the next generation of women leaders, do you think? Is it just sort of getting in the political arena and fighting for those rights?
Yes, you have to make sure that women will have to fight for their rights. I mean, nobody will do it for them. That is for sure. But you also have to make sure that society and the government can sort of set a framework which allows women to take a seat in the parliament, for example. You have to make sure that there is daycare centers for your children, that there is parental leave, that there are rules that allow you also on the labor market to actually combine being having a family and being active in on the labor market and in the political life in the society. So I think you need a combination of the two.
I'm curious at understanding what you learned from this, being in a movement on the one hand on these issues, but then taking on the responsibility of government. Mm-hmm. Is there a transition there, or is the Swedish political system such that those two things mesh easily?
They matched at that time also for me, so that I could accept. And I think also you need a partner that is supportive and can help and share the responsibility for family. This is extremely important. I left the parliament to have my first child, and it is also important to be able to come back. So I think all these conditions will have to be put in place for to allow women to take their proper place. But to me, it was also the fact that my husband has always been very, very supportive. And there was an interest in getting more women on the lists, on the party lists, to be nominated and to accept to enter politics.
Now, in your career, before you went to the commission, you actually went into the private sector, I think in communications industry, yeah, and television and so on. that must have been quite an experience, because I guess it was an opportunity to sort of sense what was going on in the realm of communication.
Yeah, I felt that it was a fantastic experience to be able to set up a regional TV station, which I did in Värmland, where I live with my family. And then we also moved, later on, we moved to Sri Lanka to do the same thing, to work for an organization then with communication. And I think you just have to, you need the experience from different sectors also in society, and not only stay in politics. And I've never wanted to become a kind of victim of politics, where they would, somebody would have to sit and say, so what should we do with her? You know, what can we offer her? But I prefer to sort of know that I have power over my own life also, and to choose my career and what I do. And I think it's very good to have to mix, not to stay too long in the parliament, for example, or in a government. I think after some time you need to change and do something else.
Now, you are presently the Vice President of the European Commission with responsibility for interinstitutional relations and communications. And so I want to unpack that, because I want to get a sense of the problems and then, you know, what you are trying to do in this realm. And Europe, I think it's fair to say, and I can quote a speech by you, has a problem, has had up until your incumbency, a problem about communication. In one of your speeches, I think laying out your strategy, you pointed out that more than 90% of the population watch TV more than 3 hours in Europe. And according to a recent Eurobarometer survey, 64% of the people are interested in news about the EU. But the EU-related information provided by national audiovisual media takes up less than 10% of the time allocated to national news. And then there seems to be more news about the presidential campaign, you go on to say, than about what's going on with Europe. How do you get a handle on that set of problems? Clearly, you're working in a field that needs to be tilled.
Yeah, the media, of course, is independent, and we cannot steer the media reporting, but we can definitely help to make also the European Union a project which is more of a democratic project than one of a rather small political elite, because I think this is part of the problem. And when citizens and the media see that we actually deal with the problems that affect people's everyday lives, then we will gain legitimacy and we will be interesting. So when we discussed recently the roaming charges or the latest telecom package, of course this is this actually affects your wallet, what is left in your wallet. So this is interesting to everybody. Or when we label chemicals or things that really has an impact on people's lives, or deal with the biggest issue for our generation, and that is of course climate change. They expect us to do that, and when we do it, we will also have the media coverage. So you have to do the right things, but you also have to do them right, and this is where democracy comes in. I think you have to engage with citizens in a better way to make it more democratic. And we also have to help media to report on what we are doing. We have to stop using a jargon that makes it impossible to understand what goes on. And we are trying to support the networks of radio stations and TV stations that can also do proper reporting about what happens.
Mm-hmm. You, in another speech, I've been reading a lot of your speeches, actually.
You were the one.
You say that opinion polls show that 7 out of 10 people living in the European Union know little or nothing about what it is and what it does. Mm. So at the first level, because I want to unpackage the functions that you see is very important, it's just information about what the EU is and what it is doing.
No, I think we've engaged too much in information, this you can send information from Brussels, you know, as being the heart of the European Union. It is communication. It's really two ways. And it's only when we start to look at it that way that we can create an interest is also in what is going on at the European level. But remember, it is still a very unique construction, mm-hmm. the whole European Union. And so far, we've put trust in the politicians to go to Brussels to take decisions for us. Mm-hmm. But today we have a directly elected parliament, European Parliament, that increasingly takes decision for us. And we need to anchor better, to listen better, to explain better, mm-hmm. and to anchor better what we do. And we have to consult more broadly, because the things we deal with, it's not only sort of the internal market of the European Union, but things that really affect each and every citizen of the European Union. So I think it's a huge challenge for this old-fashioned organization that it is. And it's not enough with information, more information. It has to be two ways. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to help.
It's an interesting challenge, because let's say you had this role in the Swedish government. That would be... in some ways, a less formidable task, because the Swedish government is not in the process of becoming, so to speak, no. in the way the European Union is.
Exactly, because still, even though we have a European Union with decisions being made every week at the European level, with these 27 member states having agreed to pool their powers on a number of issues, well-defined areas, the sort of democratic infrastructure has not yet followed, because the media is still mainly national, the political parties are still mainly national. There are not enough of these meeting places for people, the places where they can get to know each other and feel European. So I think this is where we have to build much more of that democratic infrastructure to follow and to build up also the functioning of the European Union in a more democratic way.
Has your staff followed the Obama campaign, without suggesting an endorsement of one candidate or the other in the United States, the way they have used technology to actually draw people into the campaign and so on?
We are following it very closely in Europe. We are, of course, very curious what will happen here and interested in the election campaigns as well. And what I read last time when I was here, I saw a very interesting article about the fact that they've never before been able to raise so much campaign money, but sometimes they can be at a loss on exactly how to spend it. Of course, most of it being spent on TV ads. But today, a blog that is for free can do more harm or be more helpful than maybe five of these TV ads. So there is this mix of I think, channels, communication channels, that makes it more, both more difficult and more challenging and more interesting also, perhaps,
you have a blog on
yes.
the EU site.
Mm.
So has that worked out well, in the sense of communicating with people, but on in affecting your colleagues who say, well, if you have a blog, why shouldn't I have one?
Yeah, I think they became a little bit envious, because they saw that I had so many more visitors. And, of course, at first, it attracted the interest of a lot of simply crazy people who would write anything. And it was rather vitriolic, some of the comments that came to begin with. But now it has turned into, I would say, an interesting discussion and debate, inviting also those that would not come normally to a political meeting or are part of the political establishment. So I think we are listening. We are better listeners if we use these tools. And we've started also EUTube. So it means we put out video clips on different activities that we are engaged in, so people can follow what we do to fight forest fires or airport security or chemicals or what have you, climate change.
Now, I hear you saying that it's a two-track process, in the sense, on the one hand, the information, and there was a lot of information before, and in the U.S. government, I'll refer to our government, we've gone through a period where the PR of the government, became a real problem, because it did not have the second track that you're talking about, listening to what people are saying and trying to get a flow of information coming the other way to the government so it can change policy.
Mm.
That must be difficult to do in any government, but especially in the EU, which is, as we just said, something that's coming into being. Talk about a little about those problems so that people, one could see a situation where people say, hey, yeah, track one is great, but what do you mean, or do we really want to do track two?
It's true. This is indeed a challenge, and some have called it mission impossible, you know, the one I have. I say it's mission irresistible, because I think we have to make sure that we consult better on the proposals. So today, and just to give you an example, when we prepared the new chemicals legislation that is called REACH, we actually sent it out via the internet to stakeholders, and I think we received more than 7,000 replies. That was very important to put that together to understand sort of the debate and the reactions to that chemicals legislation. So we have to do consultation on the proposals better. And the simple idea is that if we ask people, we will have a better prepared proposal and we will have a better policy in the end, better decisions. We have to engage through the political parties. We have to create some political controversy. And that we do through also allowing political foundations that can help to create and stir that that debate that is lifeblood of democracy as well. And we have to find some of the new methods, hopefully, that allow also for comments. So when we send information, it should be more of interactivity so that you can actually react to that and say, I don't like that, or I would like to see a different proposal. So you have to ensure that you open up the channels for two-way communication. And we've tested out also some new methods to engage with citizens, like deliberative polling that we've learned from the US. I think this it comes from the United States. And also citizens' consultations, inviting randomly chosen citizens who can discuss what they want the EU to do. So I think we're just sort of at the beginning of trying to find the methods we can use also at the European, the cross-border level, which is extremely difficult because we have 23 official languages also. So we have to communicate. It takes a lot of resources and time and effort to make sure that we are understood to begin with by everybody.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in generationally between the constituencies out there who would be responsible? And what I have in mind here, youth, young people, you know, in the United States, elementary school kids sometimes know more about the computers than, you know, than their grandparents and so on. What sort of problem does that raise? I mean, it would seem to be very good for the future of the EU as you're doing this, but as you get older, is there a kind of, not resistance, but an incapacity to benefit from what you're proposing?
Well, it means that we have to go from sort of the traditional understanding of communication as the newsroom of the Commission, which is a fantastic thing. I mean, we have more than 2,000 registered correspondents, and they visit our newsroom every day. But now you can also watch it on the internet, of course, what happens. But to think that it is enough to write an article in Financial Times and that you've communicated through that. But you know, most young people, they actually do not read daily newspapers, or they read them on the net. Yeah, they read them on the net. So that is why you have to prolong the life of an article in Financial Times by also putting it out there on the internet. Or you have to just complement sort of the traditional channels for information and communication with what young people use. And this is still something that we are not good enough at. So I think we will have to find the new methods to engage with young people. I think they would also prefer to do proper hands-on tasks to help Europe. I think that maybe a kind of modern Peace Corps, meaning that you could sign up to go to another member state to do environmental work or to welcome immigrants or to be engaged in projects that are very, very practical. I think that could also be a way to engage young people for Europe.
Has the European Union run into the problem being perceived as essentially a rulemaking bureaucracy? And is there a kind of deficit in idealism that your processes may help to further?
I think this was part of the background of the discussions about a new treaty or a new constitution that it was called to begin with. A democratic process leading to us wanting another type of constitution or international treaty that would rule, that would be our rule book, so to say, more modern one, a shorter, more effective and democratic sort of rule book. And I think we came only halfway also mm-hmm. with the original constitution, but this is very, very important. And I think hopefully more of what we do will be with the discussion, based on the discussion on the values that we share, because this is not purely geographical cooperation. This is really a value-based cooperation, and we should more often repeat what are those values that we share.
And that process of ratification hit a stumbling block when two countries voted the new constitution down. Was there a communication problem there that can be rectified by in the future by some of the policies that you're proposing?
This is always mentioned as one of the explanations, that people will always say, we felt that we did not have enough. We didn't know enough about this, the new treaty text. And it is also, of course, to ask a lot from people to sort of master all these rules in a new treaty or in a constitution. So it first came to stumbling block in the Netherlands and France, and then it was reworked and put to another round of ratifications. And then Ireland, the Irish, in a referendum said no. And we know that there was definitely a lack of communication and information, but it cannot only be done from Brussels. It has to be done by the politicians also in every member state, in a daily discussion with citizens. And we have to stop what we call the blame game, where it is also very easy to say, well, you know, Brussels decided this or that, ignoring the fact that it's ministers from all member states who come together every week to take decisions. So they are part of it. So there are a number of these elements that we have to look at very carefully and get rid of also if we are to succeed. I think that we have a better discussion about communication, and I hope that my motto of sort of listening better, explaining better, and going local will stay in the walls of the institutions for the future.
And this problem of local politics versus EU politics and issues is a real conundrum. That is actually reaching in to the states of Europe to achieve this communication solution that you're talking about.
It has to do with the nature of the European Union as well, because it's this whole creation of having member states, fully independent member states, agreeing on letting power over to the European level is also a structure which is very demanding from all of us to engage at the different levels with citizens to try to help to explain what goes on. And at the same time, I think that we also see that we win greater legitimacy by addressing the real problems that people see are cross-border. Climate change or energy issues and immigration or what have you, fighting terrorism, all of those things, not even a big member state can do it on their own.
Mm-hmm. So this is interesting, because what you're suggesting is the EU comes into existence in addition to stop the wars between the European states, but to address certain trans-European issues. For example, the problem of globalization, the problem of the movements of people, and so on. And so that is really the EU's agenda. And it's doing this alongside of national politics, national parties, sometimes parties in particular states that want to use the EU as a whipping boy, and so on. So it's a real communication conundrum, basically, because you're working at different levels and such that any parties or local media can use the EU as the adversary, so to speak.
No, that's true, and not only that, we are then supposed to do it in 23 languages with a very complex institutional setup that not many people understand exactly, first reading in Parliament and second reading and how does it go between the institutions, and also based on very much on consensus and compromises, not conflict. So from a media point of view, it's always more interesting with conflict to describe that. And, of course, covering the whole range of activities. We do everything from engaging in the Middle East process to down to counting codfish in the Baltic Sea. So, of course, to try to communicate this whole span of tasks and missions for the European Union is not always easy. But I think basically you have to stop the blame game. You have to have more of openness and transparency also into what the EU is and does. You have to open up the council meetings. You have to make sure that people can follow what goes on. And then that's how we also win a democratic legitimacy.
In your formal portfolio, there is a reference to interinstitutional communication, because one of the problems that I guess you must confront is the many different institutions within the EU structure that I guess can have different voices.
Yes, they have, because we have different roles, and that is totally acceptable that we will have those different roles and we will have our own separate communication activities. But I think it is also clear that to most citizens, it is very often the EU. They see that it is the EU or Brussels that have decided something, and they don't make a distinction between the institutions. And that is why we also have to make sure that we can, in order to be effective with communication, you have to plan, you have to prioritize, and you have to work in partnership. So this is what we are trying to do, also putting a kind of frame around common communication activities, agreeing on, for next year, for example, we know that we have the EP elections coming up, the elections to the European Parliament in the spring. We know that we'll have to continue on the energy and climate change package that we have. And we have the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. So if we could agree on these sort of three issues and say that we make them communication priorities for all the institutions and focus on that and put resources to that, I think also we will make a difference.
Let's look at some of the European problems, and I'm referring now to a speech you gave at Johns Hopkins, and you identified several of the challenges, and in a minute we'll get to issues that you personally care about, women and the environment. But, for example, this whole question of unemployment in Europe and the problem of what individual states want to do and what Europe might want to do as a whole. And also you mentioned the problem of the aging population in Europe. Talk a little about the way the communication strategy interfaces with issues like this, because in both cases there seem to be a national take on these problems, pensions in Italy or wherever, but then Europe as a whole trying to come up with solutions.
Yeah, and very often the starting point has to be to explain the role of the European institutions. Where does Europe have power to decide, and what is actually left to member states to decide on their own? So I think this is sort of always the first stage, is to be able to explain what does the EU actually decide on. And I think this also has to be clarified. It would help with a new treaty that could sort of sort that out to citizens and explain very clearly where we do not have competence to decide and where member states decide themselves. So, but the institutions will have a role to play in making sure that the decisions that are taken at the EU level are also communicated and that they are well prepared in what we call the public consultation phase. And I think we are using that more and more. We are more and more effective. And we use also our representation offices in each and every member state to make sure that we can listen, we can put an ear to the ground and engage with different stakeholders. We made a big wine reform, and that was an example of how you then go to every member state also to listen to with the wine growers, with environmentalists, with NGOs, with trade unions or whoever have an interest in that particular issue. And you collect all of this and you feed it into the decision-making process. But without the member states engaging, because they will know the language, they will sort of be able to put it into a context, it will be very difficult. So it cannot only be done centrally from Brussels. And that is my whole understanding and starting point as well.
Another issue that you mentioned was the whole problem of European security and as it relates to the movements of people and the integration of new citizens into Europe and so on. It would seem that though that set of issues, at least in the United States, are very controversial. You can see that by watching our immigration debate. Does that sort of pose a different kind of a challenge for a communication strategy? Because there must be a lot of disagreement about how Europe should deal with these matters, the union. So
but really, that's the normal situation. There will always be controversy. And I don't think that is, one should not fear the controversy. I think this is very good for a lively democratic debate on issues. And I just think that it makes me at least very humble to look around the table to see that we have been able to end the divide of Europe into an East and a West. We have 27 member states sitting around the same table, being able to look at how to create a common asylum policy, for example, with a clear date when this should happen, fully aware of all the problems lying ahead, but still wanting to engage in making legislation, pass legislation in all those 27 member states. That's a fantastic achievement. And I think maybe sometimes we become blind to the obvious and we should repeat what we have also done already and take credit for that. But to young people, this is not enough. You cannot only talk about it as a peace project. I mean, they would say, who cares? We don't see that there is a risk of a new European war, but instead talk about how to solve today's and tomorrow's problems and give us an understanding of how the EU can be important.
So in a way, I guess I'm hearing you say that the communication strategy is a glue to bring all the elements of the EU together, sort of walking to the future, or moving to the future in a way that incorporates all the stakeholders, institutional in the EU, in the states, but also the people.
But, propaganda doesn't work. And you have to acknowledge that first and foremost. So you have to see it as a tool for democracy. Communication is a tool for democracy. And you cannot repair a bad policy with a good sort of communication policy. You have to use modern communication methods. You have to go on the internet. You have to use the channels that most people use to get any information about what the EU is and does.
I get the sense that what you're doing, if I look at your career, that you're using the technologies to bring it together with these early experiences that you had in Sweden in politics.
Yeah.
So the teas and the local meetings and so on, you're just operating at a bigger, on a larger scale with new kinds of tools.
Well, because I have never stopped engaging myself in the whole issue of how to develop democracy. Mm-hmm. I think that we also have to look out, because if we don't defend democracy, also our right to vote, we might lose it before we realize that we've lost it. And I'm very afraid of the sort of dark forces, even Nazis marching the streets of Europe again, letting it go to those with xenophobic or other ideas. And I think we should, it's so precious that we have democratic systems, but they still pose so many problems and challenges to us. So it's the worst of systems, as Churchill said, except for any other system that has been tried. And I think it's the same in the US with globalization. Where is the room for democratic decision making? How do we, when decisions are made so quickly on the financial markets, so as we can see today, where is room for thinking a little bit about what to do, or to discuss with other people, to maybe create a new idea or a new solution? And this is the core of democracy, that you actually empower people, you believe in people, you think that they can contribute.
So we're increasing the muscles, the muscles, the tendons of democracy as it confronts new challenges. And technology is an aid in that. Now, let's look at the environment, because that's an issue that you've been close to, both in Sweden, in an earlier portfolio, you know, on the commission and so on. I mean, here one has to do a lot of political education, probably less in Europe than in the United States, but if we're looking at the problem globally. So how does this all come together in a way that is deploying this communication strategy to call the problem to the world's attention, to the citizenry's attention, and get them to act, really?
Mm. Well, to get them to act, you have to be able to say also, what are we expected to do? Is there a role for every citizen in all of this? Because it can look, climate change can, of course, look totally overwhelming. And maybe even deter people from daring to act, or thinking that this is a problem for somebody else. And you have to then break it down into very tangible or practical things and advice to people. You know, switch off. Don't let your things be on standby overnight. But change the light bulbs. Take a walk or use your bike instead of the car, etc., etc. Those things will actually contribute. They are important. And at the same time, make it very clear that it takes political decisions to deal with such a problem as climate change. And it takes global solutions. And this is, of course, where the US and Europe have been on different paths for some time. But I hope maybe with a new president that we can find a new cooperation also. But it is very important to also provide hope, I think. To say that there is hope for the world, and we have all a role to play.
Your point here raises two issues. I'll raise the first one. Is Al Gore, and I believe you wrote the introduction to the Swedish translation of An Inconvenient Truth, is Al, what does his career tell us in a way? Because he has been most successful as the leader of a movement, as opposed to being the leader of a government, I mean, on this particular issue. And so drawing on your experience in the movement and in government and communication, I mean, I guess, is communication a kind of a linkage here that sort of brings these two together?
Yeah. The timing, I would say, as well. You have to have a good timing. And I think also to be honest, I mean, he has been very consistent. This is not something that he sort of jumped on the bandwagon in the last minute and then made the most out of it, but he has been very consistent. And I think this is important. It has been an interest following him through his career. And he found the perfect timing for a very pedagogical message. And the way he described it and the seriousness with which he engaged in this issue. And he changed the debate in the United States, I would say. Not so much in Europe, because we were already in a stage where we had started to take real political decisions on emissions trading, and we were working on the Kyoto Protocol. And through our legislation, we were addressing these problems. But all of this came together. So I think it was a very important communication effort, and it created the tipping point, which I still think that the final tipping point came when there was a price tag to climate change through the Stern report. Mm-hmm. It became clear that with business as usual, it would be more expensive than if we would actually take action.
Another issue that has been dear to you is the whole question of security, women's rights, children's rights. Let's talk a little about that, because that's also a case where Sweden was ahead in the game of rethinking women's roles. Mm-hmm. But it's a problem that the EU can address, because it's really a global issue that when you have some of these nightmares of the new world, the situations like Burma or terrorism or cross-border criminality, it's really women that are most suffer in a way.
Yes, and who listens to the women? Mm-hmm. Who give women a voice in all of this? And I read a report from Darfur and the UN, the UN delegation to Darfur, they had to Jan Eliasson, my countryman, and Salim Salim, when they reported from Darfur, they had to admit a failure, because these leaders did not actually want, they didn't show any willingness to find a solution. And I was thinking, so maybe the time should have been spent only listening to the victims. And that means most of them, the women and children in the camps, in the refugee camps. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would have been even more important. And I just saw that women's voices were missing. Who discusses with them? Who listens to their needs? And this is absolutely not, this is so crucial for the survival of this planet, or trying to solve the security problems. I have never before been very active in security policy, I admit. But when I started to see that it was so biased towards a structure that was all male and men engaging with other men, excluding the women or those who are most of the victims, then it outraged me, I have to say. I really, really felt that this is something.
So what do we do about that? I mean, it would seem to be that you've got to put women in the positions of authority so that they're there to actually add a different dimension.
Live up to the UN Declaration or to the Resolution 1325. Make sure that all countries make their own national action plans. Make sure that we show that we are serious about these things. And I think there should not be any delegation sent without also a woman being part of it. If we go to poor countries, to the developing world, there has to be, always to be a woman in those delegations as well, because I think women will only talk, in some cases, will only talk to another woman. How do you explain that you've been raped in front of your family, your husband and your children? Who do you talk to? And who is willing to listen? So I think you even need quotas sometimes. You have to make sure that you live up to the excellent text in this UN resolution. But then show that you're serious about it. Not only words, nice words. They have to be turned into deeds.
Europe and the United States and our partnership is going to be important on all of these issues and in the future. And there are very great differences about how you build nations and how you do democracy, democratization, and so on. Can those differences be reconciled? And is part of the problem just differences over communication, or is it very different styles about how you achieve
these? I hope we have more similarities and more convergences than divergences on these issues as well. I mean, we are both continents that wants to see a democratic development, and we share the same basic values. They are universal values very often. And I think if the political will is there, I think we can engage in a very fruitful conversation about how to develop democracy for the future. But I think also security policy, I think, of course, what you've experienced in the U.S. with 9/11, that has influenced the thinking so much. But again, let women's voices be heard as well. And you will see that security, to build security for the long time perspective, then you have to invest in education, clean access to clean drinking water, sanitation, all of those basic things that women value in a sometimes different way than men. Mm-hmm. And as somebody said, if you think that education is expensive, try ignorance, mm-hmm. because this is really the basis of it all.
One final question. You mentioned several times hope in your here, and then I saw on your website a speech, and I read it, about hope. Talk a little about that, because you actually think that amidst all these problems, in a way there has to be a core of hope to work your way through it, and we can't lose sight of that.
No. And again, those of us who have children, could you imagine us living with children without trying to give them hope, without trying to support and help and back them up so that they feel that there is some meaning to all of this? There is hope for the future. They want to have hope for their future. They want to be able to look ahead and say, yes, we can. We can create a sustainable development where we can see the opportunities and the possibilities and the new jobs and the new quality of life that we can bring, and not only see all of this as problems and costs and a burden. But I think that is for every parent, and or maybe for every human being, we have an obligation also to nurture hope.
On that very positive note, I want to thank you for taking the time to come to the campus, but also to be on our program. This has been a very useful exchange, and I think gives our American audience a better idea of what's going on in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.